Every community has a place where people meet and stories are told. The East Coast has stoops, the South has porches, and in Alaska, we have Arctic entries.
Here, Alaskans share their personal stories, funny, sad, and sweet. These stories are originally told at our monthly events in Anchorage. At each live performance, seven people tell a seven-minute-long true story related to the show's theme.
I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards.
Welcome to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. This hour of Arctic Entries will feature stories based on the theme, Taking Chances.
You'll hear Alaskans tell stories about rolling the dice, going rogue, and living with the consequences.
Alaska is chock full of people who are not afraid to make bold, risky decisions or go against the grain. Our storytellers today each have their own spin on the theme of taking chances.
If you think about it, risk is the way in which we create space in the present for the future to be born.
All of these stories were originally told in September 2012 at the Snow Goose Theater in Anchorage.
Our first storyteller makes his living by taking chances all day long. Greg Hobson is a professional poker player who lives in Anchorage.
Yeah, my name is Greg Hobson, and yes, I've been playing professional poker for 8 years now, and it's been a pretty crazy ride. I guess that was actually probably my biggest taking a chance moment, was choosing this to be my sole source of income. And so anyway, the story is, in 2008, I was playing poker online. I was living in Portland, Oregon at the time. And I made it, things were going well. I made it to a final table of this tournament. First place was $75,000, so it's a pretty big deal. So things were going great, and then the power goes out. So I can't believe it. I'm like, really? This is the time the power's going to go out? Really? So I call up my brothers. They've helped me out on a number of occasions. So I call them up. Neither of them answers. So now I'm like, okay, what am I going to do? Okay, I know this one person who seems to follow me sometimes online. Yeah, it's my mom. So I go ahead and give my mom a call. So I call her up, and she's just like, Greg, what's going on? You're folding all your hands. What's going on? Wait, you keep on. You said you're logged out. What's going on? So, and I'm like, okay, mom, calm down. Calm down. I need you to log in for me now. I need you to play for me. And as I'm saying this, I'm just like, this is not a good idea. This is not going to end well. So my mom logs in, and I was like, okay, so mom, you have 30 seconds every time you get cards, and you have to tell me what the cards are, and we'll kind of work through this, and I'll try to tell you what to do. So the first go-around, my mom's like, okay, so there was the blinds, and then you have a jack of spades and a nine of hearts. Oh, darn it, just folded your cards. I'm like, really? Okay, this is not going to go well. I'm like, I have to, and I'm kind of starting to freak out a little bit. I'm like, I need to get back online. I need to get logged back in. So at this time, my wife, Lindsay, comes downstairs. She's studying for the bar at the time, so she's like trying to get some real rest. But she comes down because the power is out, and she's like, okay, we got it. We need to go find internet. So we're like, okay, what are we going to do? So we're like, okay, I grab my laptop. We jump in the car, and we hit the garage door opener. Oh, no, nothing happens. Okay. So we go grab the emergency cord, and then we lift it up manually. And now we're off. Okay, I got my laptop in my lap. Lindsay's driving me around. And we're like, okay, we got to find lights. Who has power right now? So we're driving around, and we're just – we finally find someone who has lights. We're like, okay, they probably have internet. Okay, we got to steal somebody's internet now. All right, so we pull up. And I'm like, okay, Lindsay, I got a signal. Oh, no, they got a password. Okay, nothing doing that. Okay, keep going. We do this repeatedly for the next, 5-10 minutes. Just keep on going a little bit, lurching forward. I've got the glow of the computer on my lap, and I can just see that everybody, if anybody's seeing what's happening here, they're like, what are these people doing? I don't know what's going on here. So we keep on going. All the while, I'm talking to my mom, trying to walk her through hands. I'm like, okay, mom, now what hands do you have? And my mom's just in a panic. She's just so nervous. She's like, well, I have an ace and a seven. Oh, okay, so now it's your turn to act. Oh, okay, mom, go ahead and raise. And then she's like, oh, darn it, already folded. Sorry about that. So we continue searching, desperately searching for internet. We're so desperate. And then all of a sudden, I lose cell reception. I'm like, okay, great. Now, Lindsay, we got to turn around right now. We got to get back to cell reception immediately. So it takes us about 2 minutes to get back on the phone with my mom. And it was a pretty eventful 2 minutes. I get back on the phone with my mom, and I'm like, all right, mom, what's going on? She's like, okay, so I had kings. I had a pair of kings. So that's a really good hand. So I raised a little bit. And then four people called, and I'm just, oh, my goodness. What is going on? This is not going to end well. And then she's like, okay. And then I went ahead and bet a little bit more on the flop. It came out 10-7 deuce. And I bet because I was still out a pair of kings. And then she's like, and then everybody folded. Everything worked out great. And I'm like, mom, what would have happened if someone would have just moved all their chips in and you had to decide whether or not to call for all your chips? She's like, oh, I was definitely going to fold. I was not going to lose this tournament while you were not on the phone. I mean, you can imagine. I mean, I'm trying to talk my mom through this tournament. I mean, think about other professions. If I was, I'm like a brain surgeon, and I'm like, hey, mom, I'm not going to be able to make it to surgery today. I really need you to go ahead and check in for me today. And I can just imagine the conversation. I'm like, oh, yeah, mom, yeah, right, the knife thing. Yeah, that's the scalpel. Okay, good, okay. All right. Oh yeah. So it would just not be a challenge. Even, not life and death with my situation, but it was a lot of money. It was $75,000. So we continued on our quest for internet. So we continued on. We kept on doing the lurching stops and searching for internet. You would be surprised. I'd say almost everybody has their internet protected. And I was very disappointed in everybody. We finally find internet, and so we pull up next to this house, probably a couple miles from ours, and I'm like, Lindsay, stop. We got internet here. So I log on. I'm like, okay, mom, I'm going to log on now. You need to log off. So I log on the internet. Lindsay pulls over next to the curb, and I proceed to have the ominous glow of the laptop in my face in front of some random person's house. And I'm just waiting for someone to call the cops, and I'm just going to be seeing red and blue lights in my rearview mirror and just, like, hear sirens coming for the police. I felt like it was so suspicious. They had to think I was, like, hacking into their bank accounts or something. Anyway, so I'm back online, though. I'm playing my tournament, and Lindsay goes ahead and jumps in the back seat. My wife, she's like, okay, I'm going back to sleep now. And I'm like, okay, I'm sitting there in the passenger seat playing along. And actually, things end up going really well. I end up taking second. So if I would have went out ninth when my mom took over, it would have been like $7,000. And so anyway, I end up taking second in this tournament. I was very happy with that. It ended up being $55,000, and I was very excited. After that, so the tournament was over. I was just closing the laptop, and I was like, hey, Lindsay, driver, you get up in the front. Here we go. So she drove us home, and I went ahead and I used my winnings. I went ahead and bought a generator the next day. So thank you.
You just heard a story from Greg Hobson. A few months before telling his story, Greg finished first in a No Limit Hold'em tournament, winning a coveted World Series of Poker bracelet and a lot of money.
Sometimes it's good to take risks.
This is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
During this hour, we hear Alaskans tell stories about rolling the dice, going rogue, and living with the consequences. Our theme is taking chances.
Each storyteller has 7 minutes to share his or her story. You may have noticed the timer during that last story. At 5 minutes, the hosts of our live Arctic Entries show let storytellers know it's almost time to tie things up. And then a timer sounds at 7 minutes to let the storytellers know it's time to make way for the next speaker.
Our next story is told by Terry Kelly, a philosophy professor at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Here's his story on taking chances, live at Arctic Entries.
Hey, thank you very much. So my son Elias is 3.5 years old, and he's already a bit of a goofball like his dad. The other day, apparently at school, he was on the top of the slide, and he was waving his hands around. And the teacher came running up and said, Elias, what's wrong? What are you doing? And Elias said, conducting my orchestra. You know, my wife Cheryl and I, we couldn't imagine life without Elias now. But, you know, before we had kids, we really struggled with the decision whether we wanted to take the risk to have children or not. You know, I've got some friends who are pregnant now, and I like to tell them, oh, wait till you have children. You'll see how empty your life was before. Before you had kids, all you had was free time and disposable income. Hey, and let me tell you, Cheryl and I, we liked our free time and our disposable income. We kind of had the worries that I think a lot of people have. What would happen to our careers? Would our marriage be able to hold up? Would I be a good dad? Would she be a good mom? Would I drop the baby? Would the baby be healthy, right? It's an existential risk, I think, when we choose to have children. We put our whole life on the line. A friend of mine, Matt, he's an economist, and he said, having children is completely irrational. It makes you a hostage to fortune, right? When you have bad luck and you have kids, you're screwed, right? Well, you know, at the end of the day, though, you know, free time and disposable income, they're not inherent goods, right? They don't alone make you happy. And Cheryl and I decided to take the risk and to have kids. And for us, it's worked out great. Elias, you know, as they say, is our pride and joy. But man, we went through some tough times getting there, though. During our pregnancy, Cheryl had what's called placenta previa. Now, for the guys in the audience, the placenta is the organ inside mommy's tummy that feeds the baby. The concern with placenta previa is that you might have some bleeding episodes during the pregnancy. We had an appointment with our OB, and the way our OB put it was, you know, the placenta's got some blood vessels in it that are about as thick as your thumb, right? And if they were to go, in the worst case scenario, you would hear the bleeding. It would be audible. We were like, yikes, message received. Take it easy, right? And so I swear to God, I did not put her to work. We took it easy. We painted the baby's nursery. We relaxed. Go to bed that night. In the middle of the night, I hear Cheryl calling me. I get up. I run in the bathroom, and sure enough, she's bleeding, right? And I'm in a panic. We're both panicking because we both have been concerned about this. We were fearing this, and then here it is. And I'm really panicking, and then I stop, and I listen. I go, wait a minute. I don't hear the bleeding. This is not the worst case scenario. It's funny how a man's mind works, right? I needed to grab that sliver of a silver lining to move from panic mode to problem solver mode, right? Got Cheryl down on the floor, covered her with a blanket, got the phone, called the paramedics, we're good to go. Until Cheryl says, whoa, if people are coming, I better get dressed. She hops up and starts putting a bra and a shirt and some pants on, and we walk upstairs, and I cover her with a blanket on the floor next to the front door so it'll be easier for the paramedics to carry her to the ambulance. Right? She's a pretty tough woman, my wife, right? So, but in all seriousness, you know, we go to Providence, and you know, and it's a very serious situation. She's only 22 weeks pregnant, and aside from her bleeding, premature delivery is the other possible problem. And at 22 weeks, as a lot of you guys know, you know, a lot of kids won't survive if they're born that early. So by the time we get to the hospital, her bleeding has stopped, and they're concerned about Elias, the baby. And so the first thing they do is they check for the heartbeat. And I'll tell you, any other time we had gotten the heartbeat checked, it was like, boom, they were right on it. It was like, psh, do, 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 do. Not this time. I don't know if it was like, you know, the nurse's first day on the job, or the machine was broken, or the speaker was broken, but it just went on and on and on. Psh, 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 psh. The first nurse gives up. She hands it to the second nurse. Psh. Well, I'll tell you, I'm sure it only took a few minutes, but to me it felt like hours. And after a couple minutes, I looked down because I didn't want Cheryl to see my face because I was starting to fear the worst. And I didn't want her to see the fear on my face. But then finally, just as I'm starting to panic again, you know, that super fast heartbeat that kids have when they're that young, when they're still in the womb. And so we're like, oh, thank God. Okay, mom is stable. Elias is okay. But it's still going to be touch and go for a few days. This is a major medical problem. It's a major medical event. We're going to be in the hospital for a few days, and the rest of the pregnancy is real touch and go. But after a few hours, I decide, okay, I better go home and get our toothbrushes and some books and our computers and stuff like that. I stumble out of the hospital. It's about 4 in the morning now, and it's the coldest night of the year in the winter of 2009. And it's so cold that freezing fog has started to fall to the ground. You know, in freezing fog, you get, you know, the moisture in the air gets squeezed out by the cold, and you get these incredibly large crystalline flakes that just float gently down to the ground. You know, and I got in the car, and I turned the car on, and the headlights came up, and they shined, and they reflected off the freezing fog falling to the ground. I just sat there for like 5 or 10 minutes and just watched the flakes fall, and they covered my car and all the cars in the parking lot. And there wasn't a sound at all in the world. You know, and for just that instant, I felt like everything in the world was the way it should be. Not that I thought that everything was going to turn out all right. I didn't know if it would or not. But it seemed to me at that moment that everything was a part of a kind of melody, a part of what Paul Auster calls a music of chance. And some of the notes are beautiful and some of the notes are sour, but they all have to ultimately hang together. Of course, Matt the Economist would say, "Pass the bong, man. I told you, you shouldn't have chosen to have kids. Look at the risks that you took, the grief that you've exposed yourself to," right? You know, and I would love to say to Matt, "Well, hey, it worked out for me because Elias is a great kid and he's my pride and joy." But I think philosophically that would be kind of cheap and easy. I mean, I think what I learned that night is at the end of the day, what makes us uniquely human is our willingness to take risk, our willingness to take our dreams and to take those chances to make our dreams real. I mean, if you think about it, risk is the way in which we create space in the present for the future to be born. Right? I'd have to admit to Matt that that night was the hardest night of my life. But on the other hand, as I sat in that car not knowing if things are going to be okay or not, I experienced one of the most pure and powerful moments of my life. And maybe that's what it's all about.
That was Terry Kelly, who remains a very happy hostage to fortune. He told his story live at the Snow Goose Theater in September 2012. You're listening to Arctic Entries on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards. As you may know, anyone may volunteer to tell a story at our live Arctic Entries events. For more on that, arcticentries.com. Our theme for this show is Taking Chances.
At each live event, we also feature music from a local artist. Here's Michael Howard performing live at Arctic Entries in September 2012.
Upside down when she headed south to a different town, far away from me and far away from every little thing that held her down. Now all my flowers have turned to seed, my peace is lifted by the breeze. I'm not rooted down in the rocky ground that used to nurture me. Washington's the widest drive, from top to bottom, from every side. We're back on our own and I'm going down to the riverside. Where there's a lover waiting there for me, this heart is restless like the sea. Her eyes are dark like the Portland sky and wet like the rain. About love, but it's feeling right. So I'll suit your purpose for tonight. Kick off your shoes and I'll hang my hat until the morning light. If I don't make it far, at least I got there. I wish I knew. heart needs space to roam. And if we're all made of stars, and our bodies are the dust, and let those northern winds carry me back. Our bets by the whiskey well, to the one who's dealt a losing hand, we live the life of a working man. When the cards laid down, fate made a frown and he slipped away. This life we've chosen is day by day. What's right or wrong, well, who's to say? But your spirit's strong and we get along. Now let's keep it that way. If I don't make it far, at least I got there gracefully. And if you're all that I need, I wish I knew what was good for me. 'Cause it was written from the start. Bodies are the dust, and let those northern winds carry me back home.
This is a story about my friend Andy, and most of it's true. The rest makes for a good story.
Andy wants to be a good man. Make an honest living with his eager hands. It seems like every time there's a load to share, you know he can't help but take it. Susie wants to be the right woman. raise a proper family in a righteous home. She's pregnant with her second right around 19. And Andy left her at 20. In the church every Sunday, asking for the Father to forgive his sins. But when Andy loved a man and he told them, the congregation never asked him back. By day he was a driller, but he dreamed of more. So Andy quit his job on the Arctic shore. And now he's painting lines with his gifted mind. The whole wide world turns to magic. Said he'd never make it, but he heeded none. And Andy's drawings told a story in a secret tongue of the future of the land and the fate of man. While all the wells kept on burning. To the country by the cottonwood trees. And she read weekly in the paper of the Arab Spring. Now there are roses in the tundra where winter used to be. Like a wooden coal, and these hands are feathered wings of each and every soul. We're living in a dream, and the greatest thing is to turn an empty canvas to a wildflower scene. And we sing, oh. Shining through their eyes. It was their father who inspired them to live their lives.
Thanks.
Thank you, Michael Howard, for the music. You're listening to Arctic Entries on KSKA Anchorage. On this show, we feature true stories told by Alaskans.
Next up, we have Ricky Tagabon. Ricky is a Chilkat weaver, a pastime typically reserved for women. This is his story about taking chances within the Tlingit community.
So, I'm from Juneau. I moved here in May, and I'm Tlingit and Filipino on my dad's side. And in the Tlingit community, and well, throughout Southeast, there's a style of weaving called Chilkat weaving because it was controlled out of this village called Haines. And it's extremely complicated. And men in our tribe are not allowed to learn Chilkat weaving unless they're gay. And so I'm going to tell you how I came out of the closet to my family. And I realized I was gay when I was 11, or about 11, and I couldn't come out to myself internally until I was about 14. And my big brother Joe, I remember he would pick me up from school kind of randomly when I was growing up, and we would drive around and spend time together, and it was always guy stuff. Joe was a dude. He was such a dude. He was a gold miner. He loved Harleys and hunting, and I remember we got coffee, we went and got Irish cream mochas with whipped cream and sprinkles, and yeah, I remember all of this very, very clearly, and we went to a gun store and looked at all the guns, and he was trying to talk to me, and I don't know anything about the lingo of guns, but I can handle them. Anyways, I remember where we were driving down Mint Way, and there's this one corner and a bunch of speed bumps, and we were going up and down these speed bumps, and it was really pressing on me to tell someone that I was gay. And I had never told anyone, and I could barely tell it to myself. And I said, Joe, I need to tell you something. And he said, he kind of braced himself. He knew that it wasn't going to be easy, and he said, what do you need to tell me? And I just started crying, and I said, I'm gay. And we had a really long conversation after this. We were almost to the house. He was dropping me off at my parents' house when this all happened. And so we sat in the car and just talked, and he had a list of questions. He said, well, are you still a Christian? And I was only 14. And he said, you know, did something happen? You know, do you feel like this is a phase? Do you want to change? Can you talk to someone about getting help? And I said, no. No, I don't, you know, I can't answer all of those questions, but I know that it's not a phase. And I'm telling you because I want you, because I don't want to have any secrets. That's why I'm telling you. Because I love you and I want to, you know, I don't want to have any secrets. And this is how it is, and I can't change. And so that was the beginning of a fun battle with my family. They're Pentecostal, so it's been a process, but I've definitely have a good relationship with my family, and my brother actually passed away a year ago on September 7th. It's been 1 year. But my story is about becoming a weaver. Being out in the Native community has actually worked in my favor with Chilkat weaving. I was in Haines about 2 years ago for a few weeks studying silver carving with a woman her name is Sue Filetti. She's been a silver carver for most of her life, and she invited me to come stay. She had a loft I could stay in and help run her bed and breakfast and use her silver carving tools during the day. And then she would mentor me at night when she was done with work. And I got an email from Clarissa Rizzle, who is a Chilkat weaver. And she said that she'd been paying attention to me for a few years, and she saw how I was in the Native community and how I respected the art and was learning the language. And she said, when she was learning in the 70s from Jenny Chenault in Haines. Jenny was the last traditionally trained Chilkat weaver ever. And when she taught this class in the 70s, she was in her 80s. And there was this older man who would come into the class and just observe every day. And he brought a loom one day and sat down with all the other ladies who were in this class. And he asked Jenny for help. And she started screaming, "Men don't weave! Men don't weave!" And she, you know, was like almost violent for this man. And this poor man left without saying. He left all of his stuff and just, you know, left. And nobody... All the women there had no idea what to do. They just felt really bad for him. But later, Jenny said, "He's not funny. Funny men can weave." And so I was invited to do Chilkat weaving, and you know, it's... I weave every day, and it's complicated and hard, and there's times when I just have to set it down. I cover it up and come back to it another day, but it's honestly, it's something I'm going to do for the rest of my life. So, thanks.
You just heard a live recording from our September 2012 Arctic Entries event.
Each month, the Arctic Entries Storyboard works with 7 Alaskans to share their stories. To listen to these stories and more, visit our website at arcticentries.com.
Our next storyteller is Mike Cox. He's not much of a risk taker. Actually, his wife once said the only surprise he ever liked was his Christmas present. But Mike is about to tell us a story about taking a big chance.
My wife also said about me, "If you open the dictionary and look for the word dull, there's Mike's picture." I was a bureaucrat for 36 years for the state of Michigan, and back in January of 10, I was getting ready to leave work, and I opened my email just before I left the door, and in there, to my shock, was an email from the governor recommending an early out for state employees. And unlike previous early outs where they had incentives, this was basically disincentives for sticking around. I was so angry that if my maledictions, my curses could have turned that woman to stone, she'd be a pile of gravel today. Well, fast forward about 5 months, and I had figured I had this 5-year plan. I had this 5-year glide path towards retirement just shot out of the sky. I was going to buy me a big honkin' RV and drive across the country because I wanted to be a ranger with the National Park Service because those Smokey the Bear hats look really cool. And that was all done. Well, I figured, what can I do? Well, 5 months later, I decided, why not work for the feds for money? And I had a job interview with the Environmental Protection Agency in Seattle, Washington. Well, the interview was in Michigan. I did it by phone. And I had that interview on July 5th, and 2 days later, my ex and I closed on our house. And for the first time in 55 years, I was actually living on my own. I took a month-to-month lease because I had a really good feeling about this job interview. And sure enough, 2 days after I moved in, they called and offered me the job in Seattle. The next day, I went to my landlord and said, "Guess what? I'm moving out." And I said to my boss, "Guess what? After 36 years, see ya at the end of the month." Well, I had gone from a 4-bedroom house in the burbs to a 2-bedroom apartment, and then I had to shrink everything down to 4 doors, whatever I could fit in my Ford Taurus. The people on Craigslist and FreeCycle made out like bandits, but I didn't care. So I was ready to leave. I got up that morning to leave, and I had a small problem. I couldn't turn my head. My neck was frozen, and I'm thinking, great, I have to drive 2,300 miles to Seattle all in the same lane because I can't change lanes to check my blind spot. So I get in the car and went. The second day on the road, well, I had no place to go. What was I going to do? So anyway, I got on the road, and the second day on the road, I decided to take a 160-mile detour because I really wanted to see the American Museum of the Fur Trade in Chadron, Nebraska. Anybody here from Chadron? Okay. Well, anyway, I pull into the museum and go to the dugout cabin of Pierre Chadron, the fur trader. It's 105 degrees. If you're thinking Nebraska, you're thinking cornfields and flat. Wrong-o. This place is desert with cacti growing on top of the dugout. I lasted 20 minutes. I went into the museum, said, that's really nice. I'm 4 hours behind schedule. I better go get gas. So I go into Chadron, get gas, get in my car. Nothing. I turn it again. Nothing. My car is dead. I call my road service, and they say, you're where? And I said, Chadron, Nebraska. And they said, what is that close to? And I went, nothing. Well, anyway, I got towed to the Ford dealership. After about 2 hours, the service rep came out and said, well, you know, we probably can't get to it. And besides, if we need parts, we can't get parts here till Monday. It's Thursday. And I'm thinking, great, I'm supposed to be in Seattle on Monday. I'm going to be without a job. So he took a look at my panic-stricken face and said, okay, let me see what I can do. And he went out with a meter or something and played with the car and eventually got it to start. What happened is one of the bolts in the steering column sheared, and the steering column was misaligned so that the car thought it wasn't in park and wouldn't start. He said, sir, no problem. Just put it in neutral, and it'll start. And I said, fine, thank you. Can I pay you? He said, no, leave. So I left. I crossed into the beautiful state of Wyoming. As a greeting from the state of Wyoming, 1 mile in, boom, I blew a tire. All my worldly possessions are on top of my spare tire. I get out, I put on the spare, I'm just about ready to lower the jack, and I look down, and I see a pair of cowboy boots standing right next to me. They are connected to a cowboy named Slim. I am not making this up. He said, sir, can I help you? And he said, and I said, yeah, help put the stuff back in my trunk. And as we're loading my trunk up, I said, can I get a spare tire in Rawlins? And he says, yeah, you can, but they'll be closed, but they'll be open first thing 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. And I said, great. So I thanked him, took off, and said, I've got road service. At least they'll know where Rawlins is if I blow another tire. Let's just go. The next day, 2 days later, I'm just outside of Spokane. I climb up on some rocks to see the beautiful Columbia River. I get out, I look down at my sandaled feet, and I look down and I see a sign that says, beware of rattlesnakes. Wonderful. I close, get back in my car, and then I arrive in Seattle. And you're thinking, okay, Mike, that's Seattle. How did you get from Seattle to Anchorage? Very simply, 1 year ago today, I got on the motor vessel Kennecott for another temporary job. But quite frankly, I'm now used to throwing my chances to the winds. But I still have my plans. My plan is still to be a ranger with the National Park Service because I still like that Smokey the Bear hat. And after my contract is up next July, that's where I'm going. That's what I'm going to do. I'm now a firm believer in what the essayist John Burroughs said, leap and the net will appear.
That was Mike Cox on Arctic Entries, proving that 5-year plans aren't all they're cracked up to be. On this episode of Arctic Entries, our theme is taking chances. We're hearing stories from Alaskans about rolling the dice, going rogue, and living with the consequences.
Our last storyteller for this show is the author of a popular political blog called The Mudflats. Jeannie Devon tells the story of how she went from emailing a friend to becoming an important voice in the 2008 presidential election.
4 years ago, my life was boring, And it was nice. And my husband and I own a little retail store here in town. And part of my nightly ritual after work, I would go home and have a glass of wine and email a friend of mine back and forth. And we had this daily correspondence. And as I began to pay more and more attention to politics in Alaska, my emails began to reflect this. And they started becoming more and more political. And I got an email from her one time after a particularly long rant, which I sort of felt was an escape strategy on her part. And she said, "You know, I think you should have a blog." And so I thought, okay, I've heard of blogs. I wasn't really sure what they were, how they worked. But I did a little bit of research, and I found a little template. And I messed around one night, and I put together this sort of framework of this blog. And then I just needed something to write. So it did not take long before my muse arrived in the form of Don Young. And Don Young had voted no on a bill which would honor mothers and the concept of motherhood on Mother's Day. And I don't think that Don Young dislikes his mother or my mother or anybody's mother, but it was one of those political maneuvering to stall something else, and it was enough for me. And I said, all right, I'm just going to do my little thing. So I put up this little post about Don Young, and I clicked publish, and then I went back to look to see if it was really there, and there it was on my screen, and I thought, that was kind of fun. And the next day I went back, and I was looking sort of in the back room and trying to figure out how all this worked, and I saw a button that said statistics. So I clicked on the statistics button, and as far as I could tell, there had been actually two people, not me, who had read what I had to say about Don Young, and I couldn't believe it. I thought, oh my, how did they find it? What did they think? It was just strange and mysterious. So then I wrote another post about Ted Stevens and another post about Sarah Palin and one about Pebble Mine. And I just kind of started writing, and I noticed that my numbers were starting to increase, and there were 8 people and then 10 people. And I thought, well, they must be coming back. They must like it, I guess. And eventually I got up to about 250 people, which I had read is sort of the natural size of a human tribe. So I was like, I have a tribe! I couldn't believe it, it was so exciting. So, and then I started to think, well, who are these people? I don't even know where they are. Are they in Alaska? Are they outside? I don't know, but I sort of felt beholden to them. And I thought, if they keep coming back, then they must have some kind of expectation that I'm gonna continue to do this. And so I had fun with it when I could in my spare time. And then August 29th, 2008 happened, and I'm sure all of you remember where you were at that time, and I was sleeping, and I have my alarm set to go off to NPR in the morning, and so sometimes I'll wake up and go, why was I dreaming about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? And then I'll realize that NPR has, like, wormed its way into my brain. So the phone rings at 5, and I pick it up, and it's my sister, and she said, did you just hear that? And I sort of rewound my little mental tape and said, did Sarah Palin just get the VP nomination? Is this possible? And she said, yes. And so like everybody else, I was sort of in shock a little bit. And then I thought about my tribe. And I thought, well, maybe some of them aren't from Alaska. And maybe some of them have questions. She's probably not very well known outside the state. So I went downstairs in my pajamas. Yes, I blog in my pajamas. And so I sat down and I thought, well, what would people like to know? They might like to know about Anwar and polar bears, and Troopergate was happening at that time, that whole big conflict. And you remember Frank Bailey and the phone call where he pressured the troopers to fire the brother-in-law. So all this was happening, and I thought, nobody probably knows this. So I just sort of sat down and did a big brain dump, and then I went and I made myself some eggs. And then I came back, and I sat down, and I clicked my little statistics button, and I had over 6,000 reads in the time that it took me to make eggs. So I realized right away, and by the end of the day, it was 60,000. So I realized that this was going to be something I'd be doing a lot of, and my wonderful husband said, I think you need to take a couple months off from the store. I'll handle those things. Just keep writing. And so I would get comments now, and I would see questions, and so I would answer the question, and that would be my next blog post. And this went on, and so I basically became just churning out what people wanted to know about Sarah Palin, and I would throw other things in there as well. And so then my numbers started going from 60,000 to 100,000 to 200,000. And one day in September, 367,000 people read this post that I wrote. And so then people started saying, well, who is this anonymous blogger? You know, and of course, right, I'm not thinking of myself as anonymous. Why would I put my name on something that nobody was ever going to read? That was just this silly little thing. But it became an issue. And I started writing about other things and offended some people on my own side, committed the cardinal sin of calling out those on your own team for bad behavior. So one of them, who was a Democratic legislator, decided that, you know, this anonymous blogger needed to be dealt with and that people should have to put their names by their opinions and all of this. And so he went on a mission to figure out who I was. I'm sitting in my living room going, really? Wow, okay. So he eventually did figure out who I was, and I got this email that said, you know, tomorrow you will be outed. And I thought, holy cow, this is bad. So he eventually did in his e-newsletter, and I spent a couple days with my pillow over my head and went through a whole bunch of trauma, decided to sort of, you know, keep going. And eventually I got another email from a reader of mine who was an author, and he said, I'm writing this book, I'm co-authoring this book about Sarah Palin, and I want you in on it. And I thought, well, that's sort of exciting, you know, what's the story there? And he goes, well, my co-author is somebody that you may know. His name is Frank Bailey. So I've spent like a couple months sort of eviscerating Frank Bailey on my blog. And I said, there's no way that he's going to want to meet with me. And he said, no, 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 just go have coffee. And I said, all right. So I got a phone call. Is this Jeannie? Yeah. You once called me the second most infamous Frank in Alaska politics. So I figured out who it was. We had coffee. I met him, I met his wife, and we talked for a long time. They were lovely people, but I still thought there's no way on opposite ends of the political spectrum that we're ever going to work together. Turns out he calls me back and says, you know what? I talked to my wife, and we had a really nice meeting with you, and we would love for you to be in on this project. And my inelegant response was, really? Why? And he said, the thing that clinched it for us, and we talked about this long and hard, but the thing that really clinched it for us was the fact that you were able to call out people on your own side. And it told us that you weren't a partisan hack and that you were able to stand back and objectively find something that you thought was wrong and talk about it. And I thought, that is amazing. The thing that had happened that caused sort of my world to fall out from under me for 3 days with my pillow over my head was actually the opportunity that gave me this amazing experience. And the least amazing part was the next 6 months that I spent reading Sarah Palin's emails, which I have to tell you is kind of makes your brain bleed. But I survived that as well. And so we wrote the book, and the book ended up getting on the New York Times bestseller list, and it all had a happy ending. And I got to thinking with the theme, you know, rolling the dice and going rogue, that I sort of feel a little bit like a fraud up here because I didn't know. The lesson that I took from this is sometimes you're rolling the dice and you have no idea that you're rolling the dice. And sometimes you tell the truth and you have no idea you're going rogue. So the best that you can do is sort of take the consequences as fate hands them and decide what you're going to do with them. So thank you.
That was Mudflats blogger Jeannie Devon on the Arctic Entries Radio Hour. That was our last story for this show, but no worries, these stories and more are available online at arcticentries.com or alaskapublic.org. You can also find information about upcoming live events on our Arctic Entries web address.
This upcoming season, our live events will take place each month at the Performing Arts Center in Anchorage. Remember that you too could tell a story at Arctic Entries. We have a list of upcoming themes on the website, along with a story submission form. Once again, that address is arcticentries.com.
Thanks for tuning in this hour. We'd like to thank the Alaska Humanities Forum, our storyboard, the storytellers for this show, and our musical guest, Michael Howard.
Thanks to our audio engineers, Wright Franklin and Eric Laufer of the Alaska Teen Media Institute, and thanks to Anchorage's own Super Saturated Sugar Strings for our theme music. This has been Arctic Entries on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to hearing your stories.
We'll leave you with one more song from Michael Howard.
When we grow up, do we have to act a bit? How should we behave as our faces age? 'Cause there's a life ahead that's left to live. For now I am yours, you know I got a lot to give. Children play, what do they make? And we can work all day, but did we sing a song? And we can worry ourselves, but does it fix everything? And with the money we make, what did we miss out on? It is what it is. I am. Hold hands, why do we let go? Why do we wear clothes? Why can't our bodies show? And when we fight, what do we win? And when we make love, what's really happening? It is what it is. I am. They fantasies, but what's really real when we open our eyes? Is it what we see and feel, or is there more to find? It is what it is. I am. I am. When we grow old, will we carry on? And if we pass on, then where do we go? We can just suppose what's at the end of this road. So what matters most is the path we're on.